So we're talking about this guy, Elijah. Elijah's a prophet around 950 BC. He comes to the nation of Israel. Israel is the northern kingdom now of what used to be all of Israel. There's a southern kingdom called Judah, and they have their own king in the line of David. But in Israel, it's the line of this guy, Rehoboam. And Rehoboam's It's the sixth in the line. His name's Ahab. And he's a mess. In fact, the Bible tells us he's the worst of all of them. And worst because he has decided to take Israel away from the worship of their God, the one true God, and lead them into the worship of a false god named Baal, or Baal, which is the correct way to say it. But I just like Baal. Is everybody with me on Baal? So Baal's being worshipped in Israel at the behest of Ahab's wife. Her name's Jezebel, and Jezebel is a Baalite. And so off they went, off the rails, worshipping this false god. And the one true God sends Elijah, the Tishbite, to tell Ahab, "Hey, we're done. We're done here. And the way I'm going to judge you and the rest of Israel is I'm not going to let it rain for 3.5 years, the Bible tells us. That's a long time. So what we've been doing the last couple weeks is kind of walking with Elijah through that drought that God caused to come upon Israel. He's been fed near a brook by some ravens, not the Baltimore football variety, actual birds. He has been led by God. The brook dries up at God's behest, and he's led by God to enemy territory in a place called Sidon in what is modern-day Lebanon, to a town called Zarephath. He's told to meet a widow there who are the poorest of the poor in culture at the time in a drought, and I'll take care of you. That doesn't seem very promising. You know, if you're reading the prospectus, you're like, maybe not. But Elijah, obedient in every case so far, follows God's leading up there, meets this widow, and God provides for them miraculously through the constant refilling of a flour jar and an oil jar. And they have biscuits, enough to feed Elijah, the widow, and her son. Last week we talked about that son and the dreadful tragedy that was his death. He dies in the midst of all that's going on. This boy who has become, I'm sure, special to Elijah as he stayed with him and his mom, he passes away. And the widow goes just bonkers, and she wants explanations and blames Elijah, blames herself. But Elijah just says, "Give me the boy." And he takes the boy up. He actually literally takes him upstairs to where he was staying on the roof of that house. But he also takes the boy up to his God, because solution never exists on this level. True solution. The only true solutions we can find come from our God. And so Elijah takes him to his God, prays for him, and miraculously the boy is restored to health. Great story. You can watch both those messages if you want online. But I get to say the part that I wanted to say. The whole reason I wanted to preach Elijah was for this message. Hey. Because one of my favorite stories from growing up in church, I went to church from day one. My parents, dad worked at a church, and so I was always in Sunday school. And we had these things back then, you got to be a certain age, but anybody grew up in the church and watch flannel graph stories? They'd take this big towel and they'd put it on this board, and they had like characters. Everybody's like, look it up. It's on, you can Google it. Connie knows what I'm talking about. And they'd have these character cutouts of different characters. It was everybody in the Bible. They had one guy and one woman, and it was every guy, and you would just tell the story with these cutouts. And I vividly remember my Sunday school teacher teaching me the story we're about to go through. I loved it then. I love it now. And we have much to learn from it together. So let's read 1 Kings chapter 18. After many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year of this drought. Okay? And God says to Elijah, "Go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth." So everybody say, yay! Yeah, it's going to rain. Anybody in Texas, where I lived in Texas, it would go all summer, 40 days in a row, above 100 degrees, no rain. Like foundations would start to crack. The earth would pull away from your house. That's how hot. But that was just 40 days, right? Floridians don't have any concept. I mean, it's a little dry right now. I just mowed my grass. It's kind of, dusty out there. But in about a month, it's going to rain every day. Like every day. If you're new to Florida, welcome. It's going to rain. Every day. So we just don't get this. For 3 years, no rain. And God says to Elijah, "Hey, I'm going to make this drought stop." And Elijah's like, "Good, great. What do I got to do?" And Elijah says, or God says to Elijah, go show yourself to Ahab. Bad. It was safe by the brook. It was kind of safe up in Zarephath. It's certainly not going to be safe in the presence of this king who wants to kill me. Elijah's the most wanted man in Israel at this time. Ahab has put all of the blame on his doorstep. The drought's happening because, you know, this prophet from God came and made it so, and it's his fault. We're going to see that played out here. Now, what happens next? I got to summarize because it's too much here. It's a long chapter. But Elijah is going to meet a guy named Obadiah. Everybody say Obadiah. Yeah, it's a book in your Bible. It's a prophet, but it's not that Obadiah. There's like 11 Obadiahs in the Old Testament scriptures. It's a fairly common name, apparently, in Hebrew. And so this Obadiah lives at this time, and he works for Ahab in the palace. And Ahab is going to, later in the story, tell him, hey, we're going to go find Elijah. I'm going to go this way. You go that way, and whoever finds him first, bring him back. But before we get to that part, we find out that Obadiah is a Yahwehist. He believes in the one true God. He's still worshiping the God that he was taught to worship, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so he worships him, and he seeks to protect those who speak for the one true God, the prophets of God, as they're listed here in this chapter of the Bible. There's 100 of them. He takes them, splits them into 50s, and he hides 100 prophets of God in these two caves and make sure that they're fed and have water to drink for this 3 years that they've been, you know, in this drought. Ahab and his wicked wife Jezebel probably would have sought to, you know, definitely persecute these prophets, maybe even kill these prophets, and so he was saving their lives. Not unlike, certain modern history things. I was in Amsterdam a few years ago, and I went to Anne Frank's house. Who's familiar with Anne Frank's diary? Yeah, so that family, can't remember their name, sorry, and you don't have to email it. I don't care. But I went to that house where she was hidden, and that family was just like Obadiah, a protector of the one who would have been persecuted. All right, so this is what happened. Obadiah's walking down the road. I don't know how far he got, and it tells us in the Bible that he meets Elijah, like mission accomplished. This was the whole thing, right? And Elijah says to Obadiah, hey, I'm going to go to Ahab. Let's go together. And Obadiah says, oh, right. And this is so interesting because the same guy who had the courage to hide prophets in a cave doesn't believe the one, you know, prophet who is actually, you know, being used of God at this time in miraculous ways, doesn't believe him at his word that he'll show up for the meeting. And he says this in the Bible. You can read it. Check on me. It's right. Actually, it's open. Check on me and see if I'm right. He says, you're not going to show up. He goes all chicken little on Elijah and says, Ahab's going to kill me because you're not going to show up. Elijah says, yeah, I'm going to show up. And Obadiah calms down. He's like, oh, okay, I'll go tell him. And then we get the meeting between Elijah and Ahab. I read that text and I was like, what's that for? Well, here's the one thing I came away with. Isn't it funny, like we who follow God now in this age, like we can have like really good days, like hide prophets in the cave days, you know what I'm talking about? Like this really courageous, you know, bold thing and have just this string and run of just honoring God in life. And then one thing happens, which, you know, really isn't that bad. It's something we make up in our heads, this fear that we produce, and we go all chicken little and we get way over here away from the will of God, the courage of God, and the strength of God in our own feebleness and frailty, right? I love that our Bible includes Obadiahs because I'm an Obadiah. I got my good days. I have my bad days. And who's grateful that God loves us still, right? All right. Well, let's read the story about Ahab and Elijah here as it gets told in verse 17. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab says to him, hey, is it you, you troubler of Israel? I know none of us in here has ever done this. None of us have ever been the cause of a problem and blamed everybody else but ourselves. No one in here has ever done that. Are you picking up my sarcasm? Some of you might be new. I'm fluent in sarcasm. That was sarcasm. We love to point the finger. It's what Ahab's doing. He's totally the cause of the drought. But he blames Elijah, and Elijah's not having it. He answers him and says, I haven't troubled Israel, but you have, right? And not just you, but your father's house before you, all the five kings that preceded you. Why? Because you've abandoned the commandments of the Lord, and in your particular case, you have followed the Baals. You've become a worshiper of a false god. So Elijah's made his case, and now he's going to make an offer. He says, therefore, send and gather all of Israel to me, in the next verse, and have them come to Mount Carmel. So how much of Israel's coming? All of them. This is a national holiday. Like, we're talking probably, you know, a week or so just for everybody to come from all of the districts and stuff and arrive at this one place in Israel. Israel's not super huge, but it would take a while by foot. And they're all going to head up to this place, this mountainous region called Mount Carmel. It's not a specific mountain. It's kind of a bunch of mountains, but apparently they knew which one they're going to. And he says, I want you to bring all the people of Israel, and then I want you to bring, and he numbers them, 450. There's 450 prophets of Baal. Working in Baal churches or whatever the equivalent was. And then there's 400 prophets of this other false god named Asherah. She's a girl. She's the goddess of fertility, okay? And I want you to bring these 950 prophets who are all eat at Jezebel's table. Now, Jezebel doesn't have a 950-seat table, okay? But that's just a Hebrew idiom that basically says she's the protector. She's the endorser of these prophets. Bring them all. And we'll meet at Mount Carmel. And so Ahab sent all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And what comes next is my favorite story in the whole, recording of Elijah's life. It's pretty long. There's lots of details. But here's what I'll tell you. When you're reading the Old Testament, some of you guys are in Bible studies and stuff like that. You're learning Bible study methods. Some of you are new to the Bible, and you're like, I don't know how to apply this to my life at all. Let me just give you a quick tip. If you're reading the Old Testament or even the New Testament, and it's called, this particular kind of literature is called historical narrative. It just tells the story of something that happened in history with God's people, right? As you're reading these stories, pay particular attention to the conversations that are happening in the midst of them. Lots of details and moving pieces, but as God speaks, or as God's prophet in this case speaks, as things are being said, a lot of times the message is being given. And the things that you need to pay attention to and apply to your own lives, they're in the words and the conversations that we read. So we're just going to watch Elijah talk today, and we're going to watch him talk in three ways. First way that Elijah talks is he talks turkey. Everybody say, Elijah talks turkey. Yeah. And then Elijah talks smack. Say, Elijah talks smack. Oh, trash, I think. But it's smack, okay? He's going to totally trash talk the prophets of Baal. And then finally, and most significantly, Elijah talks to God. Say, Elijah talks to God. All right, there. If you want to leave, that's the whole sermon. All right. But that's what we're going to do. We're going to watch Elijah talk. He starts by talking turkey. Everybody knows where that comes from? It's basically from most things that I read online, and everybody knows if it's online, it's true, right? So, but most things I read online point to the pilgrims coming to the New World and meeting the Native Americans, and the Native Americans, the pilgrims found out they were really good at trapping turkeys or catching turkeys, and so they would have their conversations, but when it was time to barter and trade, they would talk turkey, because that's what the Indians had that the pilgrims wanted, and they would trade for things. And so that's how it became kind of this saying that we use to say, for reals, seriously, pay attention, right? So this is talk turkey, Elijah style. He's going to say a very particular message here. Pick a side. You got a kind of a fence, slammed up between you there. Fall off on either side. Pick a side. Modern day prophets like the Black Sheep from the 90s, the rap group, Black Sheep, everybody familiar with them? There they are. They put it this way in that Kia commercial a few years ago. You can get with this, or you can get with that, or you can get with this, or you can get with that, or you can get with this, or you can get with that. I think you'll get with this, because this is where it's at, right? There it is. There you go, people. You're welcome. They clapped at the first service. Doesn't matter. All right, anyway. Now, too late. Doesn't count. Elijah came near to all the people in verse 21. And he asked them this question. Hey, man, how long are you going to go on? How long are we going to do this? Doing what? How long are you going to go on limping? Great Hebrew word. I can't pronounce it. But it means wavering or wandering. How long are you going to go on limping between two different opinions? We get this, right? Has anybody tried to do too many things at once? Okay? It ends up being kind of like this little dance. Like if you're cooking on the stove here, but you're trying to, fix something over here, maybe stack something in your pantry, you get everything stacked, and then you realize your pot's boiling over, but then you start hearing what you stack start falling out of the pantry, but then the water's really going crazy, and you're just like, right? And that's the picture. Now, doesn't count, bro. I appreciate it, but doesn't count. Thank you. That's what Elijah says. Can we just stop with this? Just pick a side. He says, hey, if the Lord, Yahweh, is God, choose him. But if it's Baal, fine. Choose him. And it's really interesting how the people reacted. Nothing. Crickets. Why? Because he's right. They know he's right. They all grew up hearing the Torah read. They know what God expects, and they know that Ahab's not doing it, and they're not doing it. Elijah's right. They knew you couldn't two-time God. You couldn't have something on the side with some other deity. Isn't that interesting? That's how God describes our relationship with him. It's in the context of like a marital covenant. Like he describes Israel, the Old Testament followers of God, when they stray, he talks about them whoring themselves out to other gods. It's in that realm that he makes his analogies. In the New Testament, the church is known as the bride of Christ, and Jesus is the bridegroom, and he's coming for his bride. That's us, right? But he doesn't want us cheating on our betrothed. And he speaks of it in such ways, such terms. You can't two-time the one true God. He's not about it. But we can understand, listen, we can understand what would cause these followers of God in the Old Testament to want to maybe do that. Because more options mean, in my thinking, is more possibilities. There might be, yeah, God could take care of most things, and I know he says he'll take care of all things, but hey, if Baal's real and he could, you know, help it rain, or if Asherah's real and she could help us get pregnant, hey, maybe we'll go with them and just see what they have to offer, right? And we Americans understand this probably better than anybody else because we are buried in options, right? Like, I was just curious, so I went online to find out how many offerings Amazon Prime, it's one of the streamers that I have. Do you know how many movies are on Amazon Prime right now? 5,000. You're going to need more than a weekend. There's 1,300 television shows that have multiple episodes for multiple seasons. Okay, I haven't done the math on that, but it would take a long time to watch everything on Amazon Prime. But we love it. Why? Because you like what you like, and I like what I like, and we want to scroll through the options. We want to go to Cheesecake Factory and read 50 pages of a menu. We want to walk through the mall past 12 different shoe stores that sell the same pair of shoes. Same shoes, different store. Why? Well, I might get a better price. I might get better service. I know someone who works there. Right? We want our options. And listen, options are fine in most things. I'm not bagging on options. But I am telling you, when it comes to worship, God's very clear with us. There is one option. He put it this way to his people in the early days of their emancipation from Egypt. The descendants of Isaac, or Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, had ended up in Egypt with Joseph and the story of Genesis, and they had stayed there for 400 years. They'd become the slave tribe that Egypt used to, you know, build many of their things. And God, if you don't know the story, read Exodus. It's this great story of Moses going and getting them out. But then Moses leads them out of Egypt and heads up to this mountain and hears from God, and God writes down what he expects of these people who for 400 years have forgotten him for the most part. And he starts with this. In Exodus 20, he says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. Now, maybe we don't understand what he's saying here. It's not like you can have other gods, just don't have any before him. He's saying, just no other gods. Not before me, beside me. No other gods. If you're not clear, let me say it again. In the second commandment, which comes right after it, where he says this in verse 4. He says, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven or above, or in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, these false deities. For if the Lord your God, or for I, the Lord your God, am a, what's it say? J- Jealous God. There's that relationship thing again, right? I'm not sharing you with anyone. Israel knew this, and still they chose to disobey. Tim Keller was a gift to the Christian world for a long time. He passed away recently, but he wrote some great books. One of them is Counterfeit Gods. He defines an idol for us in this modern age, because most of us aren't going to like bow to like a, a statue or something like that. Like I remember I went to a Hindu temple in Trinidad on one of my first ever missions trips, and it's like going through, it's a small world in there. It's just like all these little statues, all these little things that you can bow to. They would say of Jesus, hey, just add him to the mix. We'll just throw a statue of Jesus and we'll worship him like all the other ones. This is what Israel was guilty of doing. They worshiped the one true God a little bit, but then they had Baal, they had Asherah, and those were their idols. Our idols were a little more sophisticated. We're not going to worship some little statue, but we worship idols, and this is how Keller defines them. Is there anything that's more important to us than God? It's anything that absorbs our hearts and imagination more than God. And it's anything that we seek that will give us what only God can give. It's anything that we seek in hopes of receiving from that thing what only God can give. Let me run through these real quick. These are the typical American idols, not the show. But these are the typical American idols. The first one is what I have. We are materialists. We love our stuff. We have storage spaces rented to keep the garbage that we can't fit in our house. What is up with that? There's a new one every week. I'm like, really? There's that much stuff? We love things and the joys, the power, the prestige they give us. We feel good when we arrive materially. We like the security that money gives us, right? And money's not bad. I'm going to say this about all of these. Money's not bad. It just can't be ultimate. And it certainly should never be near on par with God. So what I have is one of our idols. How I feel, that's a big one. My emotions, my joy primarily, my contentment in life, that's what I want most. And if God can't give me that, he's out. Because my chief aim is my comfort, my contentment, how I feel. Sometimes we worship who we've been given. This one's really insidious. Because we're told to love each other, to love our fathers and mothers, and to love our husbands and wives, and to love our kids. We should, but we can't worship them. And this one's really tricky because if a kid chooses not God or chooses to walk away from God, I watch so many families just kind of follow the kid and forget God. Because we want to condone and keep and maintain what's happening with this one that we worship more than the one that we should worship, right? This one's really stupid, but people still choose to do it. They worship those who they root for, like artists, singers, and sports figures. And this one's crazy, too. Some Christians worship Christians more than they worship Christ. You know what I mean when I say that? Like they have a Christian hero, a speaker or some leader, and they go to that person's church and they worship at the altar of that person and skip on going to the one that that person's supposed to be talking about. Now, sometimes that's the person's fault because they're a megalomaniac psycho, but oftentimes it's the follower's fault because they can't distinguish between the man or the woman and the God that they serve. Listen to me say this one more time. Don't ever follow me more than you follow God. Now, I will do my best to point us in his direction, and please honor me as your pastor and leader. That's fine. But don't ever think that I've got something that you don't. We are all just a mess apart from him. Everybody with me on that? And so we don't worship Christians. We worship Christ. Anybody notice the common letter in each one of those four? The letter I, because behind every one of our sub-idols is the great idol. I love me. I'm really great at loving me. You may love me, but I love me. Like, when it comes down to me and you, I hope I choose you, but I'm guessing I'm going to choose me. Because that's just how we're wired. Sin makes us that way. Self-obsessed, self-worshiping. None of these honor God. It's not bad to take care of yourself. Please do. It's not bad to have things. It's not bad to feel good. It's not bad to love those that have been given to you. It's not even bad to, you know, root for the Lightning. I was told that I have to finish on time so we can make sure we get to the game. So all of you Lightning fans, settle down. All right. It's not bad to like those things. We just can't make them ultimate because they're not. They're just not. I don't know of any tool that's been devised to help you discern what your idols are, but I'd guess this. If you opened up your phones and you let me look at your calendar app, you let me look at your bank statement on your bank app, and you let me look at your internet history and the things that you spend your time looking to or TikToking on or whatever, they may not be your idols yet, but we'd have a good sense of where your idols might show up. Just depending on what you give your time to, your money to, your mind to. That's where the idols of our lives often surface. It's a stupid thing. It's a harmful thing. It's a rebellious thing. I mean, it's just when you choose to settle for idols instead of worshiping the one true God, you are out of alignment with what he has commanded us to do. Full stop. There's enough reason right there not to do it. But can I share with you one more? They don't. Thank you. Idols don't work. False gods promise what only the true God can provide. Idols are empty. I got this Amazon box. I'm a huge Amazon guy. If it can be delivered to my house, I'm staying home. So I needed to switch out the mower blades on my mower, and I ordered them online, and the box came to my house, and I picked up the box, and it was way too light. Has anybody ever done this with a box? And it's when I looked on the side that I realized there was a blade-size hole in the side of my box. Apparently, the three blades that I ordered for this riding mower I have were strong enough, heavy enough, whatever, to poke a hole in the side of the box. They're laying on the bottom of some truck right now. If you see that Amazon truck, wave, flag them down for me. No, they're sending me more. But I had to go through the process of calling Amazon and being like, hey, I didn't get my blades. And so I made it through the AI, phone tree, but I finally got to a human, right? And this human was very nice. It was a very pleasant customer service experience, except for the fact that I couldn't convince her that I'd not received the blades. Ma'am, the delivery came, the blades weren't there. And she's looking at the picture on her screen, right? Because that's what they're referencing. Oh, no, we have, and Amazon sends you a nice picture proof. Here's the box. It was leaning up against you. I'm like, lady, I got the, I was nicer. But I got the box. I don't have the blades. Yeah, but sir, we have evidence here that the truck came to your house and they dropped the box. Yeah. Yes, we agree. The box is here. I'm holding the box. It's an empty box. There are no blades in this box. Could you please just send me the blades? She agreed. Look at me. All those idols that I just described, any other idol that you could conjure or produce, they're empty boxes. There's no blades in them. There's nothing in them for you that will provide you what God only can. So have them. Just look. Have possessions, have relationships. Don't let them have first place in your life, because that place is reserved for the one true God. So things are going to pick up here. Elijah has given the lowdown of the showdown. That's what I call that Elijah talks turkey part. It's like, you got to pick a side. And now he's going to say, let me help you pick a side. Here's what he proposes. He says, I only am left, verse 22, as the prophet of the Lord. He says, I know I skipped the verses, guys, but it went too long for a service. All right. I am left as the prophet of the Lord, but Baal has these 450 guys here. The 400 prophets of Asherah apparently didn't show up, or they weren't involved in this contest. That's all I know, okay? But the 450 prophets of Baal, he's like, let's do this. He says, let's get two bulls given to us. I'll even give you the first draft pick. You can have the first choice so that you don't think I got some kind of underhanded something going on here. You pick first. You lay that bull out on some wood, but don't light the match. I'll do the same thing with the other bull, and I won't light a match either. Then verse 24, we're both going to call upon the name of our gods. I'll call on mine, you call on yours, and whoever answers with fire, that's the man. That's the God, all right? Pretty simple. We're going to have a sacrifice. We're just forgetting the matches, all right? And everybody in the crowd's like, let's do this. Let's go. So verse 26, they took the bull that was given them, the Baalites, and they prepared it and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon. Now, the sun rose probably around 6:30, 7 o'clock that day in Israel. So we're talking 4 hours, 5 hours, maybe 6 hours of these guys doing this. They basically called on the name of Baal, saying, oh, Baal, answer us. But surprise, surprise, no answer. No one answered. No voice. They limped, same word as the beginning, the limped thing. They limped around the altar that they had made. That's when Elijah starts talking trash. Here comes the smack. At noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, cry louder, cry aloud, for he's a God. I'm sure he hears you. Because he's real, right? I mean, he's got ears. He can hear you. Maybe he's off musing. Maybe he's, you know, scrolling through his email or something like that. Or maybe, this is my favorite part, this is like a middle school boy's favorite text of all time. Because what Elijah says about this false god Baal is that maybe he's in the pooper. Maybe he's relieving himself. Sorry if that was, I don't mean to be insensitive, but everybody, it's the book, right? Everybody, you know. So that's what he says. Hey, maybe he's in the John. Maybe he had something for lunch. Anyway, he says maybe he's on a journey, too far from his phone, can't hear it ring. Maybe he's asleep, taking a nap. Or as some scholars think, maybe he's dead because they believed Baal would die and that when he rose back from the grave, that's when the rains would come. So he even like tapped into their own theology. And he says, he's got to be awakened. If you're going to wake him up, you're going to have to step it up. See, I think a well-placed piece of sarcasm is some great communication. I don't recommend it as the only communication you give in life. But if you're trying to bring about the truth of a situation, a well-intended piece of sarcasm can be really helpful in that situation, right? But it can also, as it evidently worked here, be something that pushes people to go even further with what they're doing, which was, I think, crucial in Elijah's plan because he didn't want these prophets of Baal getting to the end of this process and saying, well, if we had just prayed harder, Baal would have answered us like God answered you. Anybody ever had that with someone? Like you play one-on-one in basketball or something like that, and that person loses, and they're like, well, I just didn't go hard. You know, if I'd played as hard as I could, I probably would have won. You know what I'm talking about, coach, don't you? That's how it works, right? It's an excuse. And Elijah doesn't want the prophets of Baal to have it. And so he says, hey, man, you guys might need to step this up. And they do. Look at the next verse. It says, they cried aloud. They cut themselves with as was their custom, with swords and lances. And the blood, everybody say, ew. Yeah, the blood gushed out of their veins. Now, scholars have tried to understand this, and they think a part of Baal worship, Baal was the god of the rains, is that their prophets thought if they made their own veins rain, that would bring about the rains that Baal was supposed to be able to provide. But whatever the case is, can we all agree? Worship service that we're maybe not interested in being part of? I mean, it's basically a mosh pit, right? And these guys are yelling and screaming, 450 of them, dust is flying, blood is dripping. And they do this, it says, look at the next verse. Midday passed and they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. Everybody knows what the oblation is, right? I had to look it up too. The oblation is basically the evening sacrifice that was commanded of Israel to have, for the one true God. And so it's coming to that time, the evening sacrifice of Israel called the oblation. But nothing has happened for the Baalites. It says there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. Why? No blades. It's an empty god. He's not real. And so Elijah says to all the people, all right, come here. Kind of like what I do with you guys sometimes. Come here. Now it's all of Israel, so he has to yell. But he says, come near to me. And then the people, some of them, came near to him, and they helped him build an altar. And I'm going to skip these verses for the sake of time, but Elijah is there at a place where an altar had been built and torn down. Scholars kind of disagree on this one, but maybe during the time of Baal worship in Israel, some Yahwehites, maybe even those 100 prophets that Obadiah was hiring, they went up on this Mount Carmel mount and they built a high place, an altar to worship God. The Baalites found out about it, tore it down, right? Possible, I don't know. But whatever the case, this altar was there, it was torn down, and Elijah decides to rebuild it. He gets some stones. Anybody want to guess how many? It's a biblical number. 12. And that, what did the 12 stones represent? The 12 tribes of Israel. Here's the problem. There's not 12 tribes in Israel. There's 10. Because there's two tribes in Judah. And so most scholars think that Elijah is basically doing a callback. Basically saying that everything that we're we're experiencing as a country, as a people, is not what our God initially intended. God wanted to be our king over 12 tribes. We wanted our own king. So we got Saul and then David and then Solomon and then we split. Now we've got two kingdoms and two kings. And this is a mess. And Elijah says, I want to remind you of how this is supposed to be. He digs a trench around the altar that he repairs, and then he tells some people to go and get him jars of water. It was probably a hip-high jar, you know, that held multiple gallons of water. And they would carry, three trips with four jars. What's three times four? Yeah, some more Israel, imagery there. But he does it also, he soaks the wood, he soaks the carcass, he soaks, and he fills up the trench around that sacrifice with water. Why? So that, again, no one can say this was a fix. Okay? Even a first grader knows, if you make it really wet, it's not going to light on fire. And now he's ready. And then Elijah talks to God. I love this prayer. It's a beautiful prayer, and it's not what you'd expect. Nowhere in this prayer does Elijah say to God, please send fire. Just doesn't mention it. Elijah had confidence that his God knew what was going on and knew what was necessary, so he doesn't have to talk about it. Instead, he prays a preachy prayer. Anybody ever heard a preachy prayer? Anybody ever broken into prayer around you and they kind of tell you what you need to do as they're praying for you? That's kind of what Elijah does here. This is how he prays. Verse 36, at the time of the offering, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and this is interesting, it's usually Jacob. His other name is Israel, right? But he's emphasizing the wholeness of Israel, the nation. Switches it up there, I think, on purpose. He says, let it be known this day, what? That you're God. Hey, you see what's going on down here. These bozos have been yelling and screaming and cutting themselves for 10 hours. Okay? I'm going to talk to you one time. And I'm not going to ask you for fire. I'm just going to ask that you show up and show out and let everybody know who the boss is around here. Now, God had been letting Israel know who the boss was for 3 years. Why? It hadn't rained. Elijah had told them, your God is going to stop the rain. But had Israel paid attention or learned anything from these 3 years? No. They had continued, persisted in worshiping their idols, even though God had made it clear that he's God and they're not. Oh, shame on them. Hey, isn't it possible that every once in a while in our lives, God gives us a very clear indication, a very clear sign of his rightful place in our lives? And we blow right on past it in the pursuit of our own idols and fail to see. Here's what I pray for everybody this week. Not that God sends fire from the sky and lights your van on fire, but that God would show you in some way that he's real and that he's deserving of your all. And you need to tear down those idols and leave them where they are. Because that's what Elijah prays for. In essence, what he's praying for is, God, glorify yourself. Wouldn't that be a great thing for us to pray? Isn't that how we were taught to pray, right? Like Jesus, when he taught his disciples to pray, he didn't start with, give us this day our daily bread. That comes later. But he says, no, let's start this way. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Know who you're talking to. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That is a longer way of saying glorify yourself. Bring about your plan in this world, in my life. Make me a part of it and use me to glorify your name. Glorify yourself, God. And then I get to me and my daily bread. And then I get to my, you know, lead me not into temptation, deliver me from evil. Then I get to me. But the first part, just like Elijah here, God, show up, show out, glorify yourself in this situation. I love that he says this too. Look what it says in the last part. Go to the next verse for me. It says, or the next piece for me, where it says, on this day, let everybody know that you're the God in Israel and that I'm your servant and that I have done all these things at your word. This is Elijah saying, let everybody know there's nothing about me that's special. Let everybody know that it's you that is worthy of their follow and worship. Work through me. I'm just a vessel. I'm a tool in your hand to be used for your glory. I love that he says that. Glorify yourself through me. But then he makes a very specific request. He says this in the next verse. He says, turn hearts back to yourself. Turn hearts back to yourself. He says, answer me, O Lord, verse 37. Answer me that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God and that you have turned their hearts back. Look at me. Yeah, it's time. Look at me. If you follow Jesus today, yes, you chose him, but you were chosen. And God drew you back to himself by his Spirit to the point where you would honor him with your follow. Right? Here's what was going on in Israel. People had left him. And Elijah prays, glorify yourself, show that you're the one true God, and draw these suckers back to you. Then the miracle happens. It says in the next verse that the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust. That's a hot fire. Not just that, it licked up all the water that was in the trench. It just disappeared. The glory of the Lord was made manifest in the fire that he sent. When the people saw that, they said, well, we're going to worship Baal for a little while longer. Good show, Elijah. I don't know how you did it. That's crazy. That's a lot of fire. But you know, we're good. We're going to keep doing this multiple God thing. It's just working for us. Is that what they did? No. It says that when all people saw this, they fell on their faces. Fell on their faces. When was the last time you fell on your face before a holy God? Ever? Like, I'm not saying you have to do that to be serious about him. But he's like on that level, right? Like he is. And should we, you know, maybe spend some more time face to the ground in front of a holy God? I don't think it'd be a bad thing. But these guys, face to the ground, made this confession. The Lord, Yahweh is that word. Yahweh is God. Yahweh is God. Read, Baal isn't. Baal isn't. So, Elijah talked turkey. Elijah talked trash. And Elijah talked to God. We're going to do that as we close. I'm going to talk turkey. And then we're going to talk to God. Everybody ready? My turkey is the same as Elijah's turkey. Look at me. You sitting on a fence right now? You kind of got God over here and all those other idols that we described vying for your attention? Here's what I'm telling you. Same thing Elijah said to Israel. Pick one. Pick one, because you can't have both. You're just going to stagger back and forth. James calls it being a double-minded man or woman. You're just not going to be, you know, experiencing God's best for you. You're not going to be at your best for him if you're divided in your attention. So, I don't know what the idol is in your life or maybe what the potential idol could be, but I'm asking you right now, deal with it. Pick a side. Confess, repent, turn, and fall on your face before a holy God and tell him he's Lord and those things aren't. The way that we do that is through prayer. And in the same way that Elijah prayed for people to turn their hearts back to God, I'm going to pray right now, after you have a chance to talk to God yourselves, I'm going to pray that God turns your heart back to him if it's not in his direction right now. Some of you, you've never met him. You don't know Jesus by faith, and you've never received the life that he gives through his death and resurrection. Come and talk to me. I'd love to share with you how you can do that. But others of you have known him for a long time, but you've just been distracted by so many other things because you think you can have God and date this thing and have this thing and do this thing. And you can't. Those things are fine, but they can't be on his level. So let me pray. Bow your heads. Pray with me. Like I said, I'm going to give you this first part just to pray for yourselves. Ask God, hey, God, am I giving you my all? Am I fully worshiping you and you alone? And if there's other things, ask him to identify them and repent of those things now. God in heaven, thank you once again for your grace and mercy, for creating us, for giving us a chance to be recreated through our faith in Jesus and have life with you again. It is so easy for us to become distracted by things that aren't you, to make them ultimate, to put them on par with you. Forgive us for that. Make us your church. Make us yours and yours alone, church. Help us tear down the idols that would keep us from you. Turn our hearts back to you, God. Deal with us. Work in our families, work in our marriages and our parenting, and just work in us. Glorify yourselves through us and turn others' hearts towards you through the things that we do for them and the things that we say to them. And thanks for being a blessing. Help us be a blessing to you, I pray. In Jesus' name.